Today's episode is brought to you by the Hippocratic Collective. Check out our shows and content at hippocratic-collective.com.
You know your anatomy, and then you open up a person, and then surprise, things are different. And like, you can use the things that are already your greatest strengths and then use them on the rest of your life. Like, and I mean the stuff that really allows you to thrive. So not the stuff that the system conditioned you to believe about how much you work, but like, imagine you took a scalpel to how much you work and you really debrided out everything that you know is not serving you.
This is Surgeons with Purpose, a show that redefines the surgeon's experience. Together, we'll normalize the taboo ways we think and feel about the world, all from a place of integrity. These are the conversations we aren't having, but should be. I'm your host, Dr. Mel Thacker. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm super excited. Dr. Joan Chan is coming on today. She is a family medicine doctor in Ontario and hosts two podcasts. Her first podcast is The Other Human in the Room, and she is going to be starting a podcast called Experiential Anatomy with a friend of hers who is an embodiment coach. She is also a co-founder. She's a fellow co-founder with me and many others of the new podcast network, The Hippocratic Collective, which is the brainchild of our friend Frances May Harden, who's also a podcaster. Who doesn't have a podcast?
You got to get a podcast or two. That's what I say.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I've listened to a number of your episodes, and I really love everything you're doing to support the surgeons out there. As a family physician, I have deep respect and love and appreciation for surgeons, as well as a certain amount of socialized fear, because some surgeons, not all surgeons, but some surgeons are a little scary to talk to.
Yeah.
You have to refer people to them. So I'm grateful to be here. And I know a lot of times why people are scary to talk to is because maybe they've been a bit disconnected from their humanity. They're overworked, they're overburdened. And so the work you're doing, I'm here for selfish reasons. If I can help spread the word that you can be a surgeon with purpose and overcome burnout, then also maybe I will have more pleasant conversations with surgeons on the phone.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, that is kind of what I'm trying to do, is to change the culture from the inside out. And I think one thing we need as a collective population of humans, the surgeons, we need more humanity in our profession.
Yes. Oh yeah. And no one was like, what am I going to do today? Strip myself of my humanity. No, like it's like the system from the training onwards, like it just absolutely demands that you forget that you're a human being in a human body 99 to 100% of the time.
Yeah.
And then we're surprised that, you know, some surgeons have bad bedside manners. Like, you don't have space to have a manner at the bedside. You are overcome and like disconnected. So I just love what you're doing. And like, as a fellow surgeon, I think that must have a lot of weight that you've like been there, you know?
Yeah. And that it's not this or that.
Yes.
It's this and that. You can be a surgeon and a human.
You can. You actually are all the time, whether you know it or not.
Exactly. We actually are. We just pretend like we're robots.
Yes. And it doesn't serve you is the number one reason. And it doesn't ultimately end up serving patients. And actually, it doesn't even ultimately end up serving the system, though the system thinks it serves them. But that's a short-sighted system.
And it's funny because like the system came from the patriarchy, right? And it came from a lot of, I mean, and again, I hate crapping on like the white men, but it was mostly a lot of white men who went into it, and they had this backing of this whole support network. They had a wife who did all of the adulting for them. Mm-hmm. All of the things were happening. And so it's like, they didn't have to come home to a second job. And we just heard probably about that. I'm sure you heard about this report, this data that came out, a study that showed that women live longer than men, except in the profession of medicine.
I didn't hear that.
It equalizes it. Though. Yeah.
Oh, that's an unsurprising and saddening fact to hear. Yeah. Also kind of validating.
Yes. Very validating. You
know? Yeah. It shows like literally what's at stake. Like if someone's like, oh, your humanity, what does that even mean? Well, your lifespan. That's what we mean.
Exactly. So, it's your life.
Let's reclaim our lives back, please.
And if we're all dying early, we can't help people. So that argument doesn't
hold water, the whole toxic martyrdom argument.
Oh, no. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, if even like, there's literally no argument. There's always a way when people are like, but what about money? But what about patients? But what about whatever? There's always actually an inverse argument for the same thing that has at least as much, if not more, evidence to really, when you think long term, say, especially like sustainability, it's very short-sighted to be like, let's really, you know, work until we drop.
Exactly. Well, I always ask all my guests this. So, I prompt you, can you tell us your story?
Oh, my story. Where do I begin? Well, I come from a family of physicians. So in terms of like my medical origin story, both of my parents are physicians, and I'm actually like fifth generation physician on my mom's side. Family physicians pretty much all the way back here in where I live in Canada. And yeah, so growing up, I always was aware that medicine was an option. Other features of my childhood that I think were formative is I grew up evangelical Christian. And so I feel like that was a really good like training environment to like do lots of black and white thinking. And this is me in no way saying that all religion is bad or anything like that. But the particular fundamentalist form that I was raised in, very black and white thinking, very in-group, out-group, a lot of very rewarded for being the good girl and for being pleasing to everyone, including the God that lived in my head. So I was like, even when you're alone, better be doing the good stuff because he's always there watching. So, and you want him to, you love him, you know. So that was all a part of my journey through like high school, university. By university, the religious part started to fade away. And I would say that was my first sort of like dogmatic deconstruction identity crisis. And it actually was like kind of traumatic, but I am grateful in the end that it happened. I think because of that, then I got into medical school and started to notice, hey, there's like dogma in this place too. And I am a little bit allergic to black and white thinking and to this is the only good way. And if you're not with us, you're against us. And like a lot of this similar teachings, if you will, in like a medical cultural thing, including like, so now it's not like God's number one, but like science is number one. But looking at who gets to define science varies, just like who gets to define God. You know, it's interesting how that can be used almost as a weapon. And I'm pro-science, to be clear, but like the way that sometimes that stuff is used of like evidence-based and science, it's interesting how that can often have like a dogmatic flavor. Like you feel like you're a heretic if you don't follow the guidelines, for example. You're like, what's going on there?
Yeah, you're a quack, so right?
You're a quack. You're immediately on the woo side. And there's some kind of mean, very sassy, mean doctors on Instagram who will laugh at you and take you down. And sometimes I still am scared about them.
They're very scary. Like,
yes. And like, and very like, oh, like, so like that sort of, they know nothing. It sort of, it reminds me of like those sinners, but now it's like the sinners against the religion of medicine, you know?
Yes.
And at the same time, I was practicing family medicine, recognizing very quickly, you cannot do this whole job. And actually, like speaking of science, like they've done studies like looking at if a family physician was to follow all of the recommended guidelines for all of like every guideline that applies to family physicians, you would require 27 hours out of a 24-hour day, 7 days a week. So you literally don't have enough time. Literally, very freeing. And so that's how I then discovered things like coaching, reclaiming my power, some time efficiency stuff that was very helpful. But like the piece that really I found to be the most helpful, and that's why it's sort of the center of the work that I offer in my podcast and teaching and stuff, is just like, I call it like recognizing the inhuman stories that we've been socially conditioned to believe about ourselves and about patients that make us forget our humanity, that then bring out the worst in us, like we were saying at the top. And I view it very similarly to like deconstructing religious beliefs, you know? So if you've been conditioned your whole life to believe like you're not allowed to say no to people, that's tricky, first of all, for a human being. It's also super tricky as a physician, because there are many times in which a patient could ask us to do something where really even like the ethical guidelines says we should say no, or like the recommended standards says we said no. And especially like if the system's always asked, the system's never going to stop asking us to do more things.
Right.
And so if we feel like we are a bad doctor and that we are lazy and that we're not a team player, if we say no to the system, that's just a recipe for, well, what a lot of us have experienced at some point, like that burnout, right? So that's why I think it's so important to like deconstruct and decondition ourselves from believing stories that are just literally not compatible with being a human being in a human body. Yes. So that's why I have my podcast and love teaching. And honestly, at this point, like, so I've been in my family practice for over 10 years and I love it. Like I am aware that most of my colleagues really hate it right now. And I think that is valid. And I have refused to hate it. and I have found my ways, including working less, including rebalancing like who I pay and how to help care for my practice. But I am like determined to not let the system take this practice of medicine from me because I love it so much. And so that's where I am these days.
That is amazing.
That's my story.
I love it. So you're telling me that colleagues hate it even in Canada.
Yes. I think like it sounds like some of the reasons are similar and some are different, you know. Certainly. So in the province where I live, Ontario, which is like, it is the largest province in Canada, I believe. It's like over 2.5 million patients don't have a family physician, something like that. They quoted a lot, many million, let's put it that way. And then, you know, especially post-pandemic, complex needs, everyone in the world's nerves are frayed. And that comes out, you know, in how patients treat us and how we treat each other. Under-resourced systems and systems that are not really incentivizing things that are useful and not really valuing the people who are actually doing the work. Some of many factors, the whole thing of literally, if you're like, I'm going to like follow standard of care, I only need 27 hours out of 24 hours in a day. Like there are features that just are increasingly unsustainable. And yeah, so I know we don't have the same like worries that many in America would have about like the payment because we are publicly funded. Though I know there's, I mean, Medicare exists and stuff, like there's pieces of that mm-hmm. in America too, right? But a lot of the system stuff is same but different. The burnout is still there though, for sure.
It's still there, yeah. And that wondrous elasticity is what Danielle Ofri wrote about in Dr. Danielle Ofri in the in her New York Times op-ed. And that is the way that the system kind of views people in healthcare is like you just add the work and it magically yes. will get done because people will bend over backwards because if you don't, yes. someone is going to get hurt.
Exactly. Oh, and we see that a lot, like especially for family physicians during the pandemic, it would be like, hey, change everything about how you work, like stay safe, but also provide care, but not too much. But like, you know, you're kind of a middle person. And then as the pandemic went on, it would be like, okay, family physicians, I know, well, they wouldn't even say, I know you're busy. They'd be like, guess what? You get to test a bunch of people. Guess what? You get to vaccinate everyone, including messages like, you're the best at it. You should do it. And like,
so good at like putting a needle on an arm.
No. And they're like, oh, it's not a compliment the way you think it is. Cause like we were already doing other things and then, you know,
do everything.
Respiratory infections come back, emergency rooms fill up, other parts of the system are struggling. And they're like, family physicians, can you do some more? And like the answer is that I don't know a person in the system that can do more, should do more. Like everyone is doing the most. We need more people / like less work, which is a tricky conversation, but one that I actually wish we were having more of, to be honest.
Yes. How do we do less work? That's a good question to ask, right? How do we become less burdened? I have thoughts about it, but I'm interested what yours are.
Yes. Cause like, I think people are like, no, because that means we'll be providing patients less care or providing less patients care or something. And the thing is that's already happening. Like we're already in a major care deficit. Okay. Like there's people, like I said, that have no family physician, for example. There, one thing certainly in Canada and in the province I'm in is that wait lists are super long for things. So we're already falling short of the goal of providing care for everyone. We're not there.
Timely
care. timely care. Yes. And like in involving like serious outcomes for people, you know, so like that's a problem. And so one of my big dreams would be that we don't have to fill out disability forms anymore. That seems very specific, but like it gives an example of like, I think for all physicians, but certainly family physicians, like it's sort of like, oh, you can do this too. So, I always think about like, what is our zone of genius in family medicine? What can we do best? And also what actually sustains us? So like, what will be attractive to people like me that will keep us in the profession? And I really think the answer is almost never disability forms versus seeing patients and connecting with them and considering what the diagnosis may be and considering the next steps. Like that's what we like. That's when people are like, I just want to practice medicine. That's like typically what they mean. But a big talking point, certainly in my province, is like the administrative burden, the non-patient facing care stuff, all of the prescription renewals and the forms and the redirect to the fourth specialist because the other three we're too full, like all of that stuff. I think there is things that we could be doing to set boundaries around what we call care and like just prioritize that first. If we have time, we can get to the rest. I actually think that is something that individually we can be setting boundaries around or delegating. And then, but as a system, it would be very powerful if that was happening on our behalf as well.
Yeah. And the administrative burden that you don't get paid for, correct?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
That's what's fascinating to me is like, as I have shifted and pivoted out of my career, I'm essentially retired, I guess, at the age of 44, but now I'm have this whole other purpose, you know, that I'm following. And I'm realizing that like, answering emails is work, you know.
Oh yes.
All of this stuff that we were told isn't work. I thought work was like patient facing stuff, like in the operating room, that's work. When you're in the room with a patient, the exam room with a patient, or you're seeing a consult in the hospital, that's all work. But everything else, my brain told me, like writing notes, like that doesn't count.
Yeah.
And I'm realizing that's all I do now. All of the patient facing stuff went away and this is still work.
It is still work. You're still using your brain. You're still like, you're not sending an email to no one for nothing. Like that communication is essential for a greater purpose. It's adding value to the world, like the world in some way. So why wouldn't it count as work? Like when we're documenting, listen, if everyone's saying that documenting doesn't matter, let's just all stop documenting then.
Or let's get paid for it.
Yes. And so I think it's like, well, no, you can see a purpose to documentation, even beyond medical legal stuff or whatever. But just like, say no one would ever sue you and no one would ever regulate you. I think we would all take notes to remind ourselves, at least. Like, so then if that is an essential part of providing care is like having these notes so you can communicate with others, then that should be part of the remuneration.
Yes. My notes were like the best. I love my notes. They were like, this is so-and-so who has a cat named Gary. And
love it. So good.
But it was more for me. My notes were for me. I was like, oh, so how's Gary? You know, like, yes. It was like my favorite part.
I mean, like those are the pieces. I'm actually very happy because like, so I use an AI scribe now. That's one specific thing that I've done that frees up some space and allows me to just focus on patients. And I am delighted how often the AI scribe, I think I've trained it because I'll like add in like, has a cat named Gary. And so I think my scribe knows now. So they'll like add like personal and then be like, got a new job. And I'm like, yes, that counts. That's medically relevant to me. And I just love it.
So funny. And it's like when you talk about the black or white thinking, the all or none, this or that, it reminds me, and speaking of like administrative burden and things, stuff that we don't get paid for. It's so funny how I hear two sides. There's like the one argument where it's like, oh no, we have all this stuff. We're drowning. There's not enough hours in the day. And then on the flip side, it's like AI is going to take the radiology jobs, or for my profession in ENT, it's like Dupixent is going to fix all the polyps and now it won't be a surgical disease. And now we're going to be out of a job. And it's like, if we cure cancer, then we're going to be out of a job. It's like this fear, too much work.
Yeah.
You're going to steal my job. Isn't that, it's both sides are like not a good story. And you have to be in that middle area. There's a gray area.
And really questioning that. I mean, like maybe someday all of the diseases will really be cured and then we will have to find more work. But I think we're very far away from that. And so say, for sure, though, like parts of generative humanizing progress to the system will involve change. And ideally, it'll involve change that actually then supports our humanity. So like for the ENTs, perhaps then is it that, well, would you not have enough work doing other things? I there are many parts of the head and neck. Like I would wonder if there would still be things to do. But perhaps then like having financial support as you transition, if you have to retrain or right, like a system ideally could support that transition so that folks could feel like, you know, the human aspect of changing what you do each day is valid. And so ideally a system would do that. And if not, could we do that for ourselves? That's like the other thing.
Yes. And I think the solution for that, you know, that story that isn't true is to not put all of your identity eggs into one basket, right? And that's what we're conditioned to do. We're told we should do that. This is a calling. You should get into this. Just like you were saying, I mean, religion and medicine are so intertwined. There's an indoctrination there. That's why you're seeing all the parallels, which is so fascinating.
Yes. Like the amount, like, so, you know, now I'm doing like coaching or talking to people about ways that they can like create space in their life for their humanity. And the number one thing says like, I want to do it. I want to say no without feeling bad. I want to set a boundary without feeling guilty. And the thing I say to them next is the way it works is you do the thing and you feel the badness. You realize that the badness is the indoctrination. It is like literally living in our nervous systems. It's not just like a mental thing. Like it's a Pavlovian response. You could say like we're really conditioned, but if you practice that over and over, you feel less bad because you decondition it. So like you can de-indoctrinate yourself. At first, you will feel bad. That's how they got you doing it in the first place, is they made you feel bad when you, like they shamed you or punished you socially or financially or whatever. Like they made you so scared of being guilted and shamed and made it seem like not overworking was a sin. And that's why now we have to like reclaim it, right? But it can be done. I think that's the most important piece of it. I think actually, well, I'll say both pieces are true, because a lot of people are like, oh, maybe I just don't have enough willpower, or it's not my personality, and that's why I can't change. And I just want to create some space around the possibility that really a lot of the reasons we do what we do is because we've been conditioned to do them and indoctrinated to do them. And so it's like this really liberatory practice, and it's a practice over time to slowly feel the guilt, feel the badness, but shift slowly over time to actually making choices that feel in alignment with like us as humans. It's a big F you to the system on as you do it. So that's very fun for me as well. But that you don't have to be stuck in those ways. Things, if anyone thinks that overworking is a personality trait, I would just like argue that that's like saying being over drinking is a personality trait, if you will, you know,
over anything.
Yes. It's something that we can shift.
Yeah. And it comes from a place of, you know, I always like to wonder, this is like Gabor Mate's thing. Like what is the good part of it? Like, why did you do that? You overworked to keep yourself safe because you told yourself a story that I have to do this in order to achieve this dream.
Yeah.
It's like that, it had a role. And so it's thinking it like that the addiction has a role. It's a very weird way to look at addiction.
It's a very helpful way to look at addiction though.
Yeah.
People, because often if you guilt and shame yourself, that doesn't actually help you stop drinking or whatever. Like often that self-compassion, which can be a tricky word for physicians, but, or just like being kind to yourself or giving gratitude to that part. That's often a really core piece of then letting that thing go.
Right. And then, like you said, you know, having that space to like get intimate with the bad feelings. I love that, like shining light, like, ooh, this is shame. With my clients, we get into like the nitty gritty. Some of them have no clue what they're feeling. You know, it's like they call it one thing and then we realize it's something completely different. Like betrayal feels very different than resentment. And so when you get down to almost splitting hairs to the nitty gritty of the emotion, you're like, oh, this is betrayal. Oh, this is shame. And then you get intimate with it and you shine a light on it and you're just like, okay, I can be here. I can feel this. Yes. I can process it and digest it from beginning to middle to end. That's, I think, when you open the door to a new identity, because you no longer need the old habits that were protecting you from having to feel the bad emotion. But what we normally do is take it and we shove it in a closet and never look at it. And then it comes out sideways.
Comes out sideways. And you see it either comes out sideways at your colleagues, at your family, at yourself.
The surgeon that you're talking to, those surgeons, yes, those mean surgeons. Like,
just feel your feelings, man. Yeah. You don't have to yell at me.
What's underneath this anger?
Sure. You know what? I've never tried that. I am curious how it would go. That would be very, actually, I can think of a few. Sorry, orthopedic surgeons. It's not just, but like there's a few in my town. Some have retired.
Sorry, ortho. Ooh. We always shit on ortho.
And I mean, I know some good orthos too. It's all good. There's no single personality trait in a profession, but yeah, it would be neat to, it would actually be neat to ask that question. Yeah. I love feelings. I would say like one piece of coaching, like the understanding the conditioned story piece was really helpful, but definitely understanding like the inhuman stories we're conditioned to believe about emotion, which maybe seems like too meta, but just that emotions are scary, that emotions can kill you, that if you feel your emotions or acknowledge them, then you're weak or less than in some way, that it's like admitting defeat. But like emotions are physiological. They are a part of us. They're not going to kill us. They're there to protect us. And maybe it's misrepresented. There's not actually a tiger, but we feel like there is one. But they're still like, the way I often put it is like they're an expression of our body loving us and fiercely trying to protect us. Does it feel uncomfortable? Yeah. And it's worth getting to know your emotions, if only to know yourself better, but especially because like, most of the things you're scared to do is because you're scared of the feeling you'll feel, or you're afraid you'll feel if you do them. So if you're not scared of feeling any feelings, life becomes a lot more interesting.
It's so fun. Doesn't it? It becomes more fun.
It becomes so more fun. You can just be like, oh, I do really want to do that. I do really want to join a podcast network or whatever. I'm nervous about it. I wonder what's going to happen, but I'm not going to not do it because I'm afraid of what feeling I might feel if something goes wrong. No, like, I actually get to just decide what I want to do and not have a feeling hold me back.
And then you get to learn how to fail. And that's so fun. Like success is such a crappy teacher, but like failure is so good. And when you start loving failing, like this will go live, I believe, after my discussion with Dr. John Russell. And we were talking about how fun it is to be bad at something and nobody gets hurt.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's so important.
Yeah. Like a TEDx talk. I'm terrified. I told myself a story. I'm terrified of public speaking. And then I'm like, well, I'm going to stand on the TEDx stage and prove myself wrong. And so if you're willing to feel humiliation, you're willing to feel embarrassment. We all went into this profession to feel like we were important and that we could serve and had a positive impact and help people. Yeah. That's a feeling state. That's why we put ourselves through an inhumane system for a feeling state. And yet we don't think emotions matter. They're everything. They're the key to the universe. We're feeling creatures.
They're the only thing that matters
to us. They're the only thing that matters to us. It's information. Oh,
that's a beautiful way of putting it. I love that. I've been actually practicing being bad at things with like music. So like I grew up like playing piano and like singing in church and stuff. But I recently joined an online choir for female physicians. Speaking of like a scary thing is like they asked me to do a solo, and I've definitely always had a story like, oh, I like music, I can sing okay, but I'm like a chorus girl, I'm an alto, my voice is kind of low, so I could never do a solo. So like the act of like preparing for and then like performing the solo on the stage in front of all these people, it was thrilling. And all the terror comes up, but like you say, like the stakes are only delightful and delicious. And like that's such a like spiritual practice now, honestly, of just like be bad at things, risk things. I think that's what's brought me to like even podcasting and stuff. Like it's so creative. And I think if we fostered that same sense within medicine, of course, within the bounds of like, we're not all just going to like experiment on live bodies. Fair. But like if we still fostered and encouraged and nurtured creativity more, I think we need deeply creative thinkers, especially for right now when, like I said, the math is not mathing to like do the job that we were set out to do. The guidelines aren't mathing. The number of doctors versus patients isn't mathing. We need like deeply creative, innovative solutions. And so like having pockets of that creativity, at least so for myself, as I like, you know, learn Taylor Swift songs or whatever, that's part of my creative process. But like each of us, while we're waiting for the system to catch up, like I think a beautiful thing we can do that is actually of service to our patients and ourselves is like time away from work in some kind of creative pursuit that reconnects us with that creative mind. I have found bringing that back to patients, I'm not afraid of my feelings in the rooms with patients, very helpful. And I'm willing to think creatively. I'm willing for them to be like, no, or like to try something and for it to go wrong and be like, and not be like, now I have to protect my professional identity. Be like, I like call things an experiment all the time with my patients now. And I used to think you can't do that. But like, if you're trying something new with a patient you've never tried before, especially like medication and stuff, like it's okay. Or at least I have found it okay to be like, hey, like this is my best guess based on what you've told me. And it sounds like this is something you want too. Let's try it. And if it doesn't work, we'll try something else. Like having that creative experimental mindset has made the job so much more satisfying versus feeling like you have to have the dogma of like, I already know all the answers. I must prove myself right. That was like a losing game.
Yes. And you're so right, because in creative problem solving is basically facing a problem that we haven't seen before and not having the ability. You weren't taught how you can attack it. And if you don't flex the creative muscle and it becomes very weak, like happens in medical training and surgical training, because they're like, these are all of the things that we know. These are all of the things we learned. This is all of the evidence that we have so far. It's all capital T truth. Take it and run with it.
You know,
and then try to see a million patients and keep up with like the guidelines and things like that. Like keep learning. But we don't ever say like you actually have to kind of open your mind a little bit and get into those creative pursuits so that that muscle stays strong. And as you're saying, like it's not just medicine. It's not just family medicine, doctors, internal medicine. I was able to be creative in my practice. I remember seeing a patient who had a really tiny salivary gland cancer. It was like a little blip in his septum that I saw incidentally. It was maybe like 3 millimeters. I biopsied it and it like got rid of the whole thing, but it was the salivary gland cancer. So I send him to Tumor Board and I'm like, hey, I don't really do cancers anymore. I just do like inflammatory disease. So let's have you go to Boston. He was like, no, no, no. I want to stay with you. Like he would not, he's like, you take care of me. And I was like, okay, I can do a wide local excision of this thing, which is right in the septal mucosa in the front, and remove the cartilage. And like, I can easily get this thing out. Of all the cancers, I feel safe taking care of this. And, you know, the way I'm going to reconstruct it, I'm actually going to, I read a paper. I just did a quick thing and I was like, oh, you can do a free mucosal graft using mucosa from the opposite side. And I was like, I've never done this before, but this is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to work and I think it'll be great, but it might not, but we'll see. And I was like, oh, and I'll fix your septum. So you'll be able to breathe and we'll get rid of this little ditzel of cancer. And so I did that. And I put this free mucosal graft and I put like, I was like, oh, I'll just put some Nasapore there. I was like, don't blow your nose. I just kind of made it up as I went along and it looks incredible. It like healed so beautifully. I was like, every time I wanted him to follow up more because I wanted to like look at my work. It, like the graft took. Yeah. And he's cancer free and you know, all of that. Yeah. That was one of those things where if I had a really weak creative muscle, I'd be like, oh, I can't do this.
No.
You know, I'm scared.
But I was, it's something new.
But I was transparent along the way.
Yes.
That's the biggest thing is like being honest and transparent. I'm not going to experiment on you, patient.
Your consent for sure.
Yeah. I'm just going to say, listen, this is what I know. And because I can think creatively and I can think of my skills and I can look at your problem, I can math it. And this is what the math did. And I think this is a good plan. What do you think? You don't have to do it. It's ultimately your body. And he's like, no, I want to do it. And it worked out.
It's so fascinating because I think we have this story and sometimes it's literally directly told to us of like, you have to be confident in the way that when people say that, they mean you have to be certain and you have to come across as like guarantees and really a bit like authoritarian with patients or they won't respect you or something. But like the times when I frequently am like, this is what I know. And this is what I don't know. And this is what I'm thinking, but what do you think? And like, which is like, you know, I'm like taking the expert hat off to a certain extent. Like I have knowledge, but I know you do too. And there's also a bunch of unknowns in this room. Right. Like, and I find that if anything, patients trust me more. I don't know if you found the same thing.
100%. And it's yeah. fascinating because I think it connects you. It's very disconnecting yes. to say, you don't know, I know, yes. this is what you should do. But it also might create safety for some patients because yes. it takes away the decision fatigue. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know the right answer. I can see how culture created that.
Yep.
Right? Where they're like, you're the big ego with the white coat. You know everything. Show up with certainty and confidence. Even yeah. if you don't have it, just pretend you do.
Yep.
And then the patient's like, oh, I feel very safe now. But then yeah. if you're someone who's like, I can't pretend that. I'm just not good at that. I have to be yep. transparent and authentic.
Just to say, it's not like this way is better than the other way, but say you're a person listening and you're like, I've never been able to really do the bluster thing. It doesn't feel authentic to me. Just know that there's room for you in medicine too. And if someone else is like, the way I do it is I kind of fake it till I make it, and that works really well for me, go off then. That's awesome too. You know what I mean? Like there's so many strengths in different communication styles. And if you think about all the patients out there, I mean, that's all the humans. Do you think all the humans like the same kind of human?
No.
We have a lot of evidence that's not true.
Yeah, so it's like, good to have diversity of humans. In yes, a profession.
And yeah, so let's not all pretend to be like the older white guy that was very authoritarian. Like he can go do his thing. And then I can go do my thing as like a half Asian, you know, mid-career woman. And that's good for me. It's okay.
I love it. I would love to hear more about how you came to the conclusion that you weren't going to be an evangelical Christian anymore.
Oh, ooh.
Can we yes. go there?
Yes. Oh my yes. God. Love it. I mean, it was definitely like a process. I think so like I had what's like I now understand is quite like a common experience where you know, I was like indoctrinated for all these different beliefs and there was all these different rules. And even though the rule was like, you know, Jesus loves you no matter what, you're going to go to heaven if you have him in your heart. There was also a bunch of other rules that appeared to also matter, if not according to the technical theology, at least to the way that you would get to belong and be a good Christian and actually, you know, being it would mean you're not falling away. So whatever, like no sex before marriage, homosexuality is a sin. Science is somewhat questionable. that one depended on who you talk to, but in my house, of my evangelical Christian, as well as physician parents, we had a book questioning evolution. So just saying like dissonance
happens.
So fascinating. And like all these different things, like people who are not Christian are definitely going to hell. And lots of debate, like what about kids? Do they get, we don't have like, it's not called limbo. What's it called in Catholic? The one that's the middle, it's purgatory. So it's either heaven or hell. And so like you have debates, but so there's all these different rules and you're supposed to also like be a contagious Christian and save everyone. Otherwise they're literally all going to go to hell. And like, don't you love your friends? And there's a lot of pressure to like market Jesus to everyone. And so that was actually kind of stressful. And then I got to university and I was still like going to keep on the cause, but then I just kept meeting people that appeared to be like morally great and ethically sound and lovely people. And they like didn't believe in God, including mm-hmm. like people who believe like maybe they did believe in God, but it was under a different religious hat, and just being like exposed to more worldviews. And that for me, that is like, then the house of cards began to crumble. One for sure was like, I'd always been taught that homosexuality was a sin. And that was just part of the standard set. If you don't believe that, means you don't believe the Bible, and the Bible's the word of God. And so that means then you're just not a Christian, basically. So that's tricky. And I started being exposed to people who were gay and was like, I don't think I can do this. Like, it just doesn't work, right? But then like, I really would go back and forth. Like it took me a number of years because I still kept craving the community. I craved the relationship I had in my head of what I mean, sometimes I really just think of it as that was me, a kind version of me, but like the Jesus in my mind, like I would crave that closeness and that sense of purpose. And so it was really like an ongoing, it's like a grief process and going, it's like kind of returning to a relationship that's not working, you know, a boyfriend or whatever.
Yeah.
It felt like that. I like give it a try again. And I just be like, I don't believe any of this. And so actually a really helpful step for me was like there's a bunch of like podcasts and people on the internet who are like a part of the ex-evangelical community. So people who have kind of gone through a deconstruction process as well and landed at different points. So some will still be like, I still believe in God, but I believe in God this way. I'm still a Christian, but in this way. And other people will be like, I'm not, I'm agnostic, I'm atheist. And like, but still like a place where you could connect with sort of what happened to you. The notion of religious trauma is an interesting one.
That's what I'm going to ask you. Is there a trauma piece to it?
I feel like there is for sure. I feel lucky and grateful that in like that relative way of like, I think specifically it was the indoctrination piece, which is more of like a small T weathering type trauma, which versus, you know, a member of the church hurting me or something. And that's good.
Yeah.
Well, of course, I wish no one had that.
Trauma, I almost, this is Gabor Mate, he talks about how like the trauma is the experience of it. So if it's like somebody's hitting somebody in the head, that's not trauma. It's the concussion that happens afterwards. So it's like a bodily experience. I mean, it's like emotions. Yes.
Oh, very much. And how those emotions were trained specifically of like, so like it shows up for me still now. I mean, like I do think, the times that like my fawning, people pleasing instinct comes out, like that was so
the good girl
prize, the being the good girl. Like I got to be the number one gold star Christian because I was so good. And so then that means that it is still hard for me to like maybe speak my mind because I'm just so used to deferring to others. And there's a way that that's like cultural and just the patriarchy, but like certainly in Christianity that was sort of emphasized additionally, you know, and so that still shows up for me. A very specific one that I've explored a lot, like with therapists and coaches and stuff, is like how, you know, many people have like a fear of being abandoned or rejected, right? Like that's a very classic kind of fear. And the way that like somatically I experience that, like the place that I sort of the smallest, youngest part of me, like really get scared is like basically what I was told hell would be like growing up. That still is like what that fear feels like, which is not burning. Like they would always just say, well, the people who go to hell, it's just an absence of love. So, you know, they were trying to make it like still not the one you want to go to, but make God seem less mean for sending people there. So it was like, if they choose to not have God's love, then that's what they get for eternity is no love. And I would picture this like horrible, dark, loveless place. And that's like still where I can go if like, I don't know, my husband's mad at me or something. It still is like the thing I fear is like the hell form. So like, you know, like those are the layers where it's still there. I also think though that post-traumatic like growth piece, like I do think the reason I feel more empowered and more capable to like see through the ones and zeros of the matrix of healthcare is because I deconstructed and recovered from that.
That is so cool. It almost gave you like a superpower of being able to have this like vision or this lens, right? That not all of us have.
Yes. Cause like for a while I also explored like atheism and I'd listen to like atheism podcasts and some atheism, I'm sure there's many, but the ones I found were all like, this is why religion is stupid and bad. This is not why useful. For sure God doesn't exist. And I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? We can't know that either. Like, this is so negative. It's still like, it's so anti versus like the place I really resonate with spiritually and like humanistically is like the both and.
Yes.
It's the in between. Like you were just saying before, it's not like we're all going to lose our jobs or we have to overwork. Like literally the only place that there is generative human flourishing solutions are in between those two things.
The middle place.
Let's like seek those. The middle place.
I love the middle place.
It's the best. It's where all the good stuff grows. It's where like life happens.
Yes. It's my favorite place. It's like, I feel like as a coach, people are always like, it's this or it's that. And I'm like, well, there's actually a third. No, there are many other options.
Yeah.
And it's so freeing.
Like so freeing. Because you feel so stuck. So many people in healthcare feel trapped, right?
You feel very
like you have to leave and you have to burn it all down. And maybe that's right. And I'm not saying that's, but like, what if there are so many other options and you have this wide menu actually to choose from? And the reason it feels hard to see those options is because you're conditioned not to see them. But like, what if there is a middle way and it's very fun to find?
And what if you know, it's okay to creatively destroy something and burn it down. Like one thing I'm playing around with, like how fun would it be to just do a thought experiment where I'm like, what if I burn down everything in my life and then I could create it again? Like, I essentially burned down my career last year. And I was like, and I'm going to show myself that I can create a career in this way. And then it's, then you show, then you like get power. It's like stepping into this power where you're like, I don't need you, system, to validate me or pay me or do anything for me because I can do it all myself.
Oh,
is that powerful?
That's so powerful. We all need that. It'll look differently for every person. And that's what's also super cool about it. Like if we think we all have to do the same way, that's now we're thinking like the system. The diversity is a beautiful thing in nature and in humanity.
And every human has their own wisdom. They're the ones who know for themselves. We're not, nobody can take my how and take my, like what I did and apply it to their life. It may or may not work. Like they're, we're so in love with the how. Give me the stuff. Tell me, give me the certainty, tell me what I'm going to get at the other end.
That's what the indoctrination does to you. The indoctrination says, I have all the answers. Don't question me. If you question me, if you doubt your faith, you're doubting God. You know what I mean? Like that. And if you doubt medicine, you're a quack or something. Versus like, think for yourself, ask questions, lead with curiosity. You can't break it. Not anything that's worth breaking. And the stuff that breaks is worth breaking.
Yeah, exactly. You won't break stuff. I mean, stuff that is actually true has been around for centuries and it transcends different cultures all over the world. Like the actual stuff that is like true will, you know, like the beginner's mind and the growth mindset and all of these like amazing things that are like a Buddhist that are just like packaged in a way, right?
Yeah.
Everything we say, I'm like, oh, I've heard this before. It's because it's been said a million different times. It just finally hit. It landed.
Finally. Oh, I love that. Don't you love when you like read things from completely different sources and you're like, oh my gosh, this is all kind of the same thing, but it's said in different ways. And some of it's proved by science and some of it's like in the oldest, most mystical religions. Like that's how you know you're on the right track. Not right as in the ultimate right, but just in the human track towards your humanity.
Yes. The human track and like the real truth, like you're right. It can't be broken. So we shouldn't be so afraid that it's so fragile.
No. So true.
Oh my gosh. So if you had something to offer all of the surgeons listening who are like, oh, I feel like I'm stuck and I feel very trapped and I've been an overachieving people pleaser my whole life. And now you're throwing this at me. Like, what do I do with it?
Well, you don't have to do anything because you're in charge of your own life. So I always say that first. So it's not like, oh, here I come and I'm the expert of your life. Nope. I'm the expert of no one's life except my own. And you are the expert of your own. And I just think surgeons, I maybe in some ways you feel like your creativity is stripped from you. But I also think like you have to be creative and adaptive and innovative because you know your anatomy and then you open up a person and then surprise, things are different. And like you can use the things that are already your greatest strengths and then use them on the rest of your life. Like, and I mean the stuff that really allows you to thrive. So not the stuff that the system conditioned you to believe about how much you work, but like, imagine you took a scalpel to how much you work and you really debrided out everything that you know is not serving you. And like, imagine you did that with your entire life. Like you actually already have a mind that enjoys some amount of doing that. And yeah, you know, there's like pain involved and there'll be a healing process and some things will bleed. Like, I mean, the metaphor is actually very rich. So it's like, you can do that. You can surgically heal and alter and remove the like tumorous things that you know are there, whatever it is, the relationship, the work setting, the task that you despise. And think about how, if you were thinking like a surgeon, like how would you address that? And it could be something really gradual that you build up over time. Maybe you do it bit by bit, or it's something, you know, it's got to all chop out at once. Like, you already have that instinct in you. You get to apply that to your own life.
Yeah. You know how to cut out the cancer. So just take it out of your own life.
You can do it. And you know, it'll be painful when you coach people on how it'll be painful when it happens. It'll be a healing process. If you're afraid of that, I mean, you can speak to yourself or hire a coach or have someone there with you, knowing it's better not done alone. But we also don't have to be surprised if there's disruption when that happens. In fact, that's part of what's needed in order to heal. So You don't have to be afraid of it.
Yeah. The human experience.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find you?
Well, you can listen to my two podcasts, The Other Human in the Room, which Mel was a guest on. So that's so exciting. As well as Experiential Anatomy, if you are interested in like embodiment conversations and a lot of yes and sort of paradigm breaking conversations. On Instagram, I'm Joan Chan MD.
Awesome.
Also like joanchanmd.com is my website. So I love working with folks in healthcare. I have a program where it's 6 months and then a retreat and you get to create space in your life for humanity. And it's my favorite thing. So all of that.
Cool. So yes. Go retreat with her. Okay. All of Please. You people, you need it.
You all need it. Yes.
I love you all. Workouts and all. All right. Yes. Thank you so much. I'll put all that in the show notes.
Amazing.
Thank you all for listening. I love Joan. She is such a wealth of information and she is so insightful. I would love to end this podcast on the concept of essentialism, which is exactly what she's talking about, doing less but better. Go out and get the book, Essentialism, written by Greg McCowan, and read it. We need essentialism in the profession of medicine, in the profession of surgery. We can do less but better. We can dissect out and resect out and debride out all of the non-essential things. They are overworking us. They're leading us to burnout. They're sucking the joy out of the profession. And if we all do it, we're going to all be forced to change the culture and to shift the norms, right? And so please read the book Essentialism by Greg McCowan. Take care of yourselves. If it doesn't serve you and it's not essential to your life, go ahead and get rid of it. I hope you all take care of yourselves and have a great day. I will see you next week.
Hey, surgery is the one profession that has not figured out how to capitalize on the magic of coaching. That stops today. The Empowered Surgeons Group is a revolutionary, transformative group coaching experience that is now enrolling. It is enrolling forever, but the reason you're going to want to start today is because you don't want to waste another minute to feel better. You don't have to spend your life feeling anxious or angsty or frustrated or irritated on the daily. You're going to want to sign up at courses.melthackercoaching.com/courses/empowered surgeon or click the link in the show notes. I will see you inside the group.